The Gambling Files podcast presents Desert Island Discs with your host, John Bruford. Hello and welcome to another edition of Desert Island Discs, the completely unique show that has no correlation, likeness to, or was inspired by anything else that may have an even vaguely similar name. I'm your host, John Bruford, and I'm going to kick off by just telling you a little bit about the concept, just in case you're new to this. So we have guests who are generally leading lights, luminaries, if you will, thought leaders, if you want to use a really shitty buzz phrase, within the gambling industry generally. And they are, imagining that they are stranded on a tropical island. And it's key that it is a tropical island. There's a lot of vegetation. All of their basic needs are taken care of. So food, shelter, etc. Most food. They don't have any desserts. All the basics are taken care of. They are just choosing things to kind of keep them sane. But it's a way of looking at their life and their journey to where they are today. So our detainees, I don't know, our stranded geniuses get to choose three albums, three books, three movies, one song, not on the albums, one pet from any point in their lives, one object, one dessert, and two pieces of advice from their older self to their younger self and vice versa. Now that you're familiar with the format, it's probably a good time to say sponsorships are available. And to meet our guest. Our guest today is best known for being the head honcho of ICE when it was becoming what it's become. Really needs no introduction, so I don't really know why I'm doing this. None other than Kate Chambers. Kate Chambers, hello.
Hi, John. Delighted to be here. Thank you for that intro.
What's it like being Kate Chambers, Kate Chambers?
Bit odd sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't always recognise what people say about me, but that's fine. Everyone's entitled to how they think and feel.
Kate? Everybody, opinions are like assholes, and nobody wants to hear mine.
Well, that's what they say about what is under every ponytail.
A horse's ass.
An arsehole.
So I used to have a ponytail though, Kate. I know, hard to picture.
Just saying.
No, that's fair, and I appreciate your candour in saying that.
You haven't got one anymore, so step in the right direction.
Yeah. Does that mean I'm not an arsehole? No, it doesn't.
No,
definitely am. But Kate, let's get into the meat and two veg of why we're here. I think, I know you're a big music lover. So let's start with your three books.
Okay. Slightly different. This is so hard because I'm a big reader as well. And out of all the books I've read, trying to choose three was really difficult. I have to say.
That is the challenge.
But the first one is an Emil Zola book, Germinal. I've read it translated from French, not in its original. But I first picked it up. My dad had Germinal and Earth and another one I can't remember the name of on his bookshelf. Oh, God, when I was growing up, And one day I picked it up, Germinal, the old Penguin that had a green cover on it, which actually I've stolen from him and is now in my bookcase because I've read it four times. But I picked it up when I was quite young, and I've read it four times. Amazing. Quite a heavy read.
What's it about, Kate?
It's about the French miners and their struggle and dealing with you and what it was like to be a miner in France way back when money was tight and they were very poor. It's a similar story to Earth, that was about the French farmers. But Germinal is an interesting read, I guess, in terms of what it says about humanity and the struggle that you go through trying to earn a living and provide and, you know, life, I guess.
Yeah. Do they go on strike in the book, Kate?
Obviously.
Good, I'd have been disappointed if they didn't.
They're French.
It would have felt like, was he writing about the Dutch?
Well, and they'd never heard of air traffic control back then, so...
And of course, Emile Zola is the grandfather of Gianfranco Zola, who played so wonderfully at Chelsea Football Club. I say grandfather, I'm not sure they are related at all. That's an interesting first choice. It's quite a heavyweight first choice, and also it's one that I haven't read. I do remember they did make a movie of it. I think Depardieu was in it.
Yeah, they did.
But movie any good?
These things, the book is better than the film.
Well, I think if it's dealing with the human condition.
Well, you have to use your imagination and you create the figures and you know what they look like and you create feelings for them. This is why I think the younger generation miss so much. You know, my son says, have you read the book? No. It's like, well, you know, go and read the book.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, heavyweight, but a book I love.
Is that, do you think also how you encountered the book is an important part of why you love it? Do you think having that link to your dad is there? Do you think that's important?
Yeah, I think I'm more like my dad. My mum loved Doris Lessing. And, oh my God, I did try. But I can't bear all that alliterative, the wind was making the trees' leaves rustle and they were 100 shades of green and blah, 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 blah. No. I couldn't get into it. So I think I naturally went to my dad's reading tastes. He had quite eclectic taste, but I read a lot of books that were his on the bookshelf. Yeah.
You got any thoughts on D.H. Lawrence, Kate?
Oh, well, I did English Lit at A level, so and D.H. Lawrence was on the list. I do quite like D.H. Lawrence. I haven't read it for a long, long time, anything of his. But yeah, I think there's an undercurrent running through the stories or the narratives that he has, which is interesting.
I did A level English for about a month and then I jacked it in because I realized I was going to have to read Sons and Lovers for a year. And I just said, I am not reading this shit for a year. I hated it. Any fool can write down just a never-ending description of some shit that's around them. Take me on a journey.
Well, exactly. I want a beginning, middle, and end.
I want to do something that I can't do sitting here. I want to see somebody else's life. I don't need a description of a fucking colliery that takes three pages. That's just horribly inefficient.
Oh, God,
one of the reasons I love.
You might not like Germinal then.
I think you're right. I think it's doomed.
Well, have a go. Have a go with Germinal. Probably pick it up 50p in a second-hand bookshop.
I'm pretty sure it'll be outside in a bucket saying, please take.
Yes, probably.
No, I love really efficient writers. Like writers that work at brevity. And you know, maybe that's,
I don't know, I use a lot of words. And when I write, I use a lot of words. And I've had to make myself be more concise. Maybe that's why, I don't know, maybe that's the thing about Doris Lessing.
But theoretically, concision is very difficult.
The trouble is, you always end up making very short sentences.
Which reads like AI these days.
Well, that's a difficult thing. Is if you're very wordy and you cut it, you end up writing short sentences, but then have to join them all back up together again.
There's a little period in American fiction, well, I say a little period, but there's a little period, and it's quite a sort of pulpy crime period. Like Raymond Chandler is the great example of incredible brevity in his writing, and just not a single word. There is no flab in any of his stories. He is not messing about, but you get everything. You're not left wanting. You're not left thinking, well, what about? There's none of that. And everything is propulsive. Everything moves story. I think Robert Parker did the same thing. And I do find I'm attracted to that kind of writer. But today, Kate, is not about me. It's about you. What's your second book?
I chose a book which actually I've recommended to quite a lot of people.
To by D.H. Lawrence?
No. It's actually a business book.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called Create the Future by Jeremy Gutcher.
Made up name. How'd you spell it?
G-U-T-S-C-H-E. In fact, I've got it here.
Fancy.
It's a double book.
Whoa.
But I love it. It's a working book.
So it's got pictures?
It's got a lot of pictures.
Oh, I like a good picture.
It's about disruptive thinking.
As opposed to disordered thinking. That's probably the difference between you and me, Kate.
Well, I quite like saying, people say, why should we do that? I quite say, well, why shouldn't we do that? Why not do that? You've heard me say it a lot. Let's have a go. But a lot of people aren't brave enough. But this book, I mean, I've been doing it for a lot of years. I mean, that's one of the reasons why ICE works so well, was because we pushed at the boundaries all the time and could never really put my name on it or put my name on it. I could never work or put a name on the process. And then I came across that, and actually an intro for an advertising agency in ALF, and suddenly what I was doing had a name and I could suddenly explain it. So I think confidence at trying something new, confidence at pushing the line and boundaries is something that innately we lack. And I think social media these days particularly, and AI is not helping, makes us more inclined to think the same so we fit in. And I think the disruptors are interesting and don't get the credit they deserve a little bit.
That's very kind of you to say. I appreciate that. Thanks.
Well, you're disruptive. I'd like to think I was disruptive.
I used to always get thrown out of class at school.
I was good at school. I never did anything bad.
How this boring. Is my surprised face.
Yeah, really boring.
So when did you...
school, so...
That's kind of fair. You don't mess with the Maudlin sisters.
No.
So at what point did you find this book? I mean, is it one that you've just had kicking around for decades, or is it a relatively new find?
I came across it probably 10 years ago, roughly.
I think 10 years is a reasonable enough time for you to appreciate its value, because it's easy to be wowed by a book. Oh, no, totally. It's easy to be wowed by a book when you've just read it.
Yeah.
But for it to still have value 10 years later suggests that's a potent title.
I think for people that are scared to be a bit disruptive or to say why not, that actually giving them sort of a process to make them feel more comfortable doing that, and that book does that. It just gives you a bit of a helping hand on how to be disruptive, because the ideas have got to come from yourself. But actually, I think it's a bit of a roadmap, and it helps.
Okay.
It's all good.
Book three, Kate.
Interesting. So despite my intellectual and heavyweight first choice, I quite like to escape. And I like a book that doesn't challenge me at all, that I can literally read, put down, pick it up the next night before I go to sleep, read a couple of chapters, and it won't test me up here.
Yep.
So, funny enough, my husband reads them, so when he's read them, I pick them up, which is just Lee Child's, the Jack Reacher books.
They do fit that category.
Exactly. So they're not, for me, particularly intellectually stimulating. Spend my whole day thinking, writing, coming up with ideas, trying to be disruptive. So actually, it's pure escapism. Don't have to think about it. I can pick it up, put it down. I steer away a bit from chick lit, because I can't bear all that, you know, going on holiday and falling in love and finding the one and coming back and they're all the same.
Yeah, but that's just one facet of what's this. Chick lit is used in such a derisory way.
Yeah.
But there is some fantastic chick lit out there. Marion Keyes wrote, I mean, she's famous for, I think the big book for her was Watermelon. But the one after it, Lucy Sullivan Is Getting Married, is a phenomenal bit of writing.
Yeah.
It's a terrific book. She's a terrific writer. Dismissed as chick lit.
Yeah, but then I like science fiction too.
Oh, yeah.
I've read The Site, you know, Silos on Apple TV at the moment. I've read those three. I've read Passengers, which is vampire-like. Not vampires, but how they created them and how they took over the world. And then how the humans that survived took it back. So, you know.
You read things.
I read quite a lot, yeah. So much so I've run out of book space, and now there's three piles of books in the entrance to my bedroom that are just up, growing up the wall, because I don't know where to put them. And I don't like throwing books away.
Okay, I moved to house recently, and almost everything that I moved was a book.
Yeah. I love the feel of books, although I do read a lot on Kindle. But I love the feel of a physical book. I don't like anything bent on it. I don't like damaging the spine. I don't like... Unfortunately, journals like that. My copy of Journal, but...
Well, I think that I'm not precious about books. I love books. I'm not precious about them, because I think that what happens to them is just part of their journey with you. And so if it gets creased a little bit, I'm like, I'm okay with that. It's not a problem. I don't treat them with disrespect. I was really surprised by how much I like the Kindle.
Yeah. Well, I used to go for a two-week holiday and you pack six books. I was like, how much space does that take? And I was like, do I take that one? No, it's too thick. But if I don't, that means I've got to take two instead of the one thick one. Well, the Kindle solved that problem, which means actually now I can travel a lot with hand luggage instead of having to find space for two books.
I used to pack 10 books for G2E, because it's one on the train journey down, it's one on the flight over, one on the flight back, one on the train journey back. So that's four. And you want a selection while you're there, but it's at least two in the week as well.
See, a Kindle solves all of that, doesn't it?
It does.
And you're not restricted to the books you've taken.
Also true. Although I've got a stack of stuff downloaded to mine. But the I took it to Vegas recently, and it was a bit of a godsend. It fits in your pocket. It's a very clever bit of design.
It is.
You know, I have no... But my favourite thing about it, and I've probably said it on this podcast before, my favourite thing about the Kindle is that I can read in bed with the light off. So in the summer, when I've got the window open, I don't get eaten.
Yeah, big issue.
That's a major factor for me. That's a big part of my love for it. But okay, Lee Child's Jack Reacher books. Have you read the very recent ones, which were written with his brother?
No.
So I think it's the last three were co-written with his brother.
Do you know what? I can't even remember the titles of the ones I've read.
Yeah, that's how I feel about them too. I mean, they're amusing, but check out the Robert Parker Spencer series. They're really excellent.
Are they?
They are. And there's shitloads of them. He wrote them from about 1972 up till he died, and then a guy called Ace Atkins took them over, and he's also an excellent writer. There's about probably 55 books in the series, and they're all really, really fun and really interesting.
Which could solve my problem for the rest of my life.
Really could, but they're a lot shorter than most of the Lee Child books. But the ones that he's written with his brother, who weirdly, I think his brother's name is Andrew Child, which is really odd because Lee Child is a pseudonym. So why would, you know what I mean? It's like, so your brother's had to take on the same pseudo surname. That's bizarre. But there, you can tell that there is another hand in there, not least because weirdly, and this is a really odd thing for me to notice, but I did notice it. There's one book in particular where every character that you met for a good 100 pages was a former Manchester United player.
Oh.
And really fringe players as well. Like there's a character called Ronnie Walwork. Like who the hell remembers Ronnie Walwork? Exactly.
Exactly.
It's very peculiar. And I probably only knew about that because I used to work on a Manchester United magazine. Anyway, by the by. So, Kate, as I say, you're a big music fan. So what are your three movie choices?
Well, what I did was, I guess, movies, schmovies. First one I chose actually was Passengers, which... maybe again, I can just watch it without thinking.
Is that the Jennifer Lawrence one?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
It's a bit sci-fi. I quite like the fact that, despite the fact of how it happens, that they're sort of marooned on a spaceship for 80 odd years. And they're the only two, and they convert this spaceship into a farm. I think there's something quite nice about the whole movie. It drives my husband nuts. But
it's a controversial movie for you to say there's something quite nice about it, because I've seen criticisms levelled at it for the whole Chris Pratt, and...
waking her up.
Thawing her out because he, hey, I like the look of this one. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it is an odd movie.
It is a bit of an odd movie, but quite, I guess it's the struggle of, and the reasons why, what an appalling thing to have done. But people, when they're, facing, well, nobody knows, facing potentially the rest of their life alone, who, when there's like 500 people downstairs and you can wake any one of them up, who knows what they do. So I sort of get it, but how appalling, obviously. But the fact that, and her reaction to when she finds out, holy shit, I'd probably be exactly the same, particularly because she had a big life plan based around it. But I just quite like the movie. I think it's quite interesting. I quite like the challenge of it. Quite like the outcome of it.
Also, I think it's about it. I think it's fair to say Jennifer Lawrence is always good value.
Yeah, she's hilarious. When you see her as her, she's hilariously funny.
She's
unaffected by it all.
Really, really seems like a really nice person.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing her, and I was telling my daughter about the first movie I saw Jennifer Lawrence in was Winter's Bone. Have you seen Winter's Bone? Fucking hell. it's a bit grim, to say the least. And there's this scene in it where I forget the precise details, but she's being pressured by the police, I think, or somebody's looking for her dad, and she finds out that her dad's been killed, and she is pressured to prove that he's dead. And she has to go into a swamp in the middle of the night and cut his hands off to take them as proof that he's dead. It is every bit as grim as it sounds. And she is phenomenal. She is a wonder in it. And I watched that and I was like, gee, I don't know who this girl is, but Jesus Christ, she is extraordinary. To do that and make it believable is just like, holy cow. And I said to my daughter, well, I saw Jennifer Lawrence in this movie called Winter's Bone, and it's got this scene in it. It's quite disturbing, and it's a bit odd, and I can't really explain it to you because you're a kid. But when you're older, I'll totally let you watch it. So she went on YouTube.
Of course she did.
But she couldn't find it because it is a little independent film, and it's one of those things where if you take that scene out of context, it's like, meh. If you watch it in the movie and you see her journey and you understand all of the interwoven relationships, then it's a very different experience.
Maybe that's a theme that's running through. I quite like the journey, the beginning, the middle, and the end, or the beginning and the middle, and then the continuation of that journey is quite interesting.
And Passengers is quite literally a journey, mate.
Yes.
Okay, and it's a recent movie as well. What's your next film?
I chose Ocean's 11.
Which iteration?
2001.
Wow.
I'll tell you why. It's because on one of my many trips to Vegas, I had dinner with Jeffrey Silver.
I love Jeffrey Silver.
What an interesting man.
Mm.
And obviously is tied back to that.
When the mob was still in town.
Exactly.
So he was on the gaming control board, wasn't he?
Yep. It was just four of us at the dinner. It was quite noisy. It was at a restaurant in one of the big casinos, and which was an Italian restaurant. It was really good. And we sat and we chatted all evening. I was surprised he gave me that much time as I questioned him heavily, obviously about his life. Interesting. So I guess I get the movie. It's Hollywood. It's, you know, a movie. But I also understand actually what actually went on behind the scenes, which makes it, I guess, slightly more interesting to me.
Yes. It's an interesting production.
Yeah, and I've been to the Mob Museum, and I've been down to, you know, Kenny Epstein's casino and talked to Roy Student and spent a lot of time with those older guys who remember Vegas as it was. And I think that whole era and the transition that it's been on to where it is now is quite an interesting one. But how you can shift a narrative.
I had Jeffrey on my first podcast, The Bruford Files, and he was quite an early guest. It's like third or fourth episode, I think. And it was just a fabulous conversation. I mean, he's a lovely guy. And it was a recommendation. I think Jen Gaynor recommended him. I think she was working with him at the time. And he came on, he talked about his time at the Gaming Control Board and the mob being in town, all that jazz. And it was really interesting. And then he blew my mind by just dropping something casually into conversation. So Jeffrey spent some time as an operator as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was, I can't remember what the casino was. That's going to bug me now. When he was operating a casino, he said, I was just waiting for some food. I was in line at a fast food place. And I thought to myself, why don't we put one of these in the casino? Look at how popular they are. So Jeffrey Silver was the first person to put a fast food franchise into a casino.
He was at the Landmark and the Riviera.
It's the Riviera.
Yeah.
It's the Riviera. But what's fascinating about that, particularly in the US context, is that the restaurants were all unionized and the fast food joints weren't.
Oh, ka-ching.
Yeah, it's wild. It's absolutely wild. But it's also industry changing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And I just love how he just did it.
Another disruptor.
100%.
I love the disruptors in this world. Particularly in this industry.
So speaking of disruptors, Jerry Weintraub, who produced Ocean's 11, was OG disruptor. I mean, so there's a terrific interview where somebody asked, you know, how did you get the city of Las Vegas to agree to shut down all the lights on the strip for that scene? He said, I just phoned all the owners of the casinos. Because what a lot of people don't realize is that Weintraub's background isn't movies. Weintraub's background is music. He wrote a tremendous autobiography called When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. And he talks about all sorts of stuff in the autobiography, and the guy has some incredible stories. I was lucky enough to meet him and interview him. And so I heard a lot of these firsthand. He was a genuinely amazing man. He's the closest thing to a self-made man I've ever met, because that the idea of a self-made man is just an absolute myth. But he was like brought up by his bootstraps, no education, produced Broadway shows, managed Zeppelin, The Who, Hendrix, etc. for their US operations. He broke and changed forever. This is disruption on a massive level, right? Weintraub went to Colonel Tom Parker repeatedly, and he was just, it's an amazing story. And he's like, in fact, I think it's in the Elvis Presley in concert movie. I think some of the story is covered in that. He goes to Tom Parker and he's like, look, let me do the tour. Let me put Elvis on tour. And Parker's like, you can put Elvis on tour if you turn up with $1 million in cash. Right? And Weintraub's like, where the fuck am I going to get $1 million in cash? Phones everybody he knows. He's had success. You know what I mean? He's doing all right in the world. He somehow gets $1 million together. Goes to see Colonel Tom Parker, who was a massive gambler. Meets Parker in Vegas, gives him $1 million. Parker says, okay. Introduces him to Elvis, and they then work together. But what that changed was that prior to Weintraub and Elvis meeting, all tours were organized regionally because all states had different unions and different setups. There was no such thing as a nationwide tour. Elvis Presley was the first artist to do a nationwide tour of the US. And because it was Elvis and everybody wanted him, it broke all of the union strangleholds on the smaller venues. It basically broke the unions on music venues because it was Elvis.
Mm.
And Weintraub somehow made that happen. It's just, that guy's life is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's somebody I'm a huge fan of and comfortably one of the most charismatic people I've ever met.
Well, I'm glad my choice is resonating with you, John.
It's also, Ocean's 11 is also a really decent movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Steven Soderbergh. That guy can tell a story. But it's... I'm not going to say it's necessarily aged brilliantly, because I was watching it the other night and my other half said, yeah, let's put something else on. But it's such a fun watch. It's like, if it's on TV, you'll watch it to the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I can support you on that, Kate.
Cool.
Sorry to go on about Weintraub, but it's a bit of a hero of mine.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but it's about you, Kate. And with it being about you, what's your third movie?
Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one.
Wow. I was not expecting that. And we also have a 2/3 of your movies are Chris Pratt.
Yeah. Don't know why that is.
Yeah, coincidence. Tall, handsome gentleman.
And I'll tell you why I chose that.
Tell me why, Kate.
When I was going through that part of ICE, when I was trying to not reinvent it, but trying to move it on, give it a bit of, you know, this, and trying really hard to put a name on this, because people used to ask me all the time, you know, what ICE had that made it different from everything else. And I had to go, it has that thing. That as an organizer of events, you're searching for the thing, that thing.
Yeah.
I was really struggling to explain it, describe it. But I knew how I wanted ICE to make people feel when they came in the door. And when you watch Guardians of the Galaxy, they play a song whose name, title now escapes me. That first track where Chris Pratt lands his spaceship, goes into that cave, cavern, and dances, and he kicks things and jumps and on his way to get the sphere. The way that I felt when that song was playing and watching that scene was exactly what I wanted people to feel when they thought about ICE, came into ICE on that opening morning. And trying to describe that to the team I had was really hard. So do you know what? I went and bought a PlayStation, actually. Got the company to put a screen up at the end of the office, went and bought the movie, and I made them all watch it because it was the only way that I could at the time was try to tell my team how I wanted people to feel at ICE, and everything they did for ICE was with that feeling in mind. Great movie, but it's that opening. Was it a Pina Colada song? Something?
It's Come and Get Your Love by Redbone.
Yeah, you just looked it up. Good.
I did just have to look it up because I'm like, I know the scene, I know the song, I can't think what it is.
It gives you such a great feeling. It's full of life, it's energetic, it's makes you feel good.
And it's also a movie that was an absolutely monster hit out of nowhere.
And made him a star, made Chris Pratt a star, really.
Totally did. But it even the producers didn't expect what happened.
No, amazing.
Yeah, and again, it's a really fun film. Mm-hmm. It's prolonged Vin Diesel's career, rightly or wrongly.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all more recent than I would have guessed that you were going to go for.
Look, there are many. There are many, but...
I was maybe expecting, I don't know, the original Thomas Crown Affair or something like that.
No.
Because you're a classy, classy lady, Kate.
Look, I do you know what? I love Gone with the Wind. I've watched that movie hundreds of times. I love Gone with the Wind. I've read the book two or three times. But actually, for me, these choices are the ones which are better, you know.
I also love Gone with the Wind, Kate.
I like Casablanca, but it's, you know.
Gone with the Wind is one of the most undervalued movies, I think, in the modern age.
Love it.
It's a beautifully made film, and it's so gorgeous to look at.
Yeah.
And also, did you know, if you went by ticket sales, it is still by far the biggest movie in history. Well, nothing else even comes close.
Not even Avatar, that they keep saying.
Not even in the same ballpark. Avatar has grossed money, but in terms of just ticket sales, Gone with the Wind is everything and then some.
Yes, it was groundbreaking when it was released.
It was a cultural phenomenon, but the beauty of what they did. I mean, this is some gorgeous marketing.
Yeah.
Because the book was obviously a big deal. Mm-hmm. But the search for Scarlett O'Hara went on for months and months and months. That's a little bit of genius.
Yeah.
And it helps that she's really, really damn good.
And which woman isn't slightly in love with Rhett Butler, you know? I knew I was.
I couldn't possibly comment, Kate. But it was also, if I remember correctly, it was the first Oscar awarded to a person of colour.
Yes.
Although she was not allowed to be nominated in the actor categories, it was a special award.
And she couldn't appear either, could she? But did they let her in to the ceremony?
Of course not. No. That would be wild. Well, I don't think so. Off the top of my head, I'm not looking that one up.
No.
Because you never know what your algorithm's going to do then.
No, exactly.
Yeah, it's full of great performances. And of course, you've got the absolutely iconic fire sequence, which is just incredible.
Yeah, they
couldn't
the backdrop,
possibly
film they?
Now.
And they only had couldn't one go at it.
It's just, it's magnificent. Like, filming anything with fire is enormously difficult. One of my favorite science fiction movies of the 1950s is Thing from Another World. It's this incredible scene where the thing. All these people are waiting to trap him and burn him. And they're in this dark room. They want him to just walk in so they can chuck petrol on him and burn the shit out of him. And he chucks the door open. He's silhouetted in the doorway. And they throw this fuel on him and they set fire to him. And the only light in the scene is from this burning bloke.
Yeah.
Like, imagine how difficult that would have been to photograph. And of course, they're all covered in mattresses and stuff, trying to avoid this burning alien. And like, you scrape down the mattress and you just got these four sort of burning claw marks down it. That's so difficult to film. Sorry. Anyway.
We talked about horror this morning, though. Started. And you know, I was a bygone hero of Hellraiser 2. So can't watch horror anymore, though, like that.
Maybe that's an age thing, Kate. Maybe it's going to come
maybe
to me.
Maybe I'm getting a bit old.
No, I don't think so, Kate. Okay. Now, I know you're a big fan of desserts, Kate. So what are your music choices?
Again, it's quite eclectic, really. And this was really hard. I bet everyone says it. My first choice is Fleetwood Mac, Rumours.
Wow. One of the biggest selling albums in history.
I love it. I've always loved it. I can remember playing it at parties in my youth. I can remember playing it in the car. I can remember playing it last week in the kitchen. It's just, for me, maybe it's just, it's probably not the soundtrack of my youth, but just the album's a great album. and how it was all written, you know, tough one.
Okay. So, I mean, you say not the soundtrack of your youth necessarily, but...
I can't remember the year it was written, though.
It's about 1976, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that.
But as I say, it is one of the biggest selling albums in music history. And hugely influential. I've never emotionally connected with Fleetwood Mac.
Well, when I was growing up, there was Dire Straits and Fleetwood Mac and Bowie. Different genres of music, and you sort of sat in a couple of different camps. But Fleetwood Mac was one that I guess me and my group of friends really liked. But we also liked Meat Loaf and Bowie, and we used to have parties and we would choose an artist and that's all the music we'd play all that night. So we had Meat Loaf parties and Bowie parties and Fleetwood Mac parties. And it was a group choice, but when it came around to my party, I was given Fleetwood Mac. So I can remember going to sleep. My dad had a record player, because they were all on LPs then, and you could hit repeat until someone, after like the 10th time the album had played, because we were all camping out in my living room, said, "Turn that bloody record off." Because after 10 times on repeat, it was like too much. But good album. Good album. A bit of something for everyone, I think.
Okay, standout track?
I quite like Go Your Own Way.
Okay.
Or Secondhand News is always a good one, isn't it?
I've no idea, Kate.
Yeah. Go Your Own Way.
No, I will. What's your second album, Kate?
It's got to be a Bowie album. I remember going into a record shop where I grew up in North Devon and trying to find The Man Who Sold the World, and they didn't have it. And I asked for it, and they said, "Oh, you have to order it." And I said, "Okay, I'll order it." He said, "Are you sure you want that?" I went, "Yeah." But that's not the album I've chosen.
Okay.
I've chosen Hunky Dory.
Okay.
Love David Bowie. I went to where my dad lives. It's in this like cul-de-sac area. And during the war, I live in Twickenham, and the stadium has overflow parking on two green fields on the side of the road. And during the war, there's some debate about whether it was the American Air Force or the Italians built a row of Nissan huts that they staffed their servicemen in. At the end of the war, when they were all dismantled, this close asked if they could keep one as like a community hall. So this close where he lives has this community hall. And once a year, they put on a festival called Gladstonebury, because the name of the street is Gladstone Avenue. And it was on Saturday night. And my dad, who's nearly 90, me and my husband sprang him up and said, "Right, we're going." He goes, "Oh." But actually, it was a really good night. And there were kids of like 6, 7, 8 that the adults played music for, and they sang. And there was all these, and somebody chose Nirvana, somebody chose ABBA, somebody chose... But one of the songs they played, considering that all the kids were there at the front row, all singing and dancing, was Heroes by David Bowie. So I was delighted that a young band had chosen Heroes. My dad was going, "What's that? What's that?" "It's David Bowie. Do you not know? You heard me singing it, playing it in my youth." But Hunky Dory is one of my favourite albums.
Okay. I don't think many people are going to argue with that.
It's brilliant. Brilliant, yeah. A lot of what he's got did was brilliant, but it's all down to personal choice, isn't it?
But it's another disruptor. I mean, on a massive scale.
Yeah. Reinventing himself and disrupting everything.
Yeah.
And even now, he's still influencing.
He is one of the, you know, you can see these, there are little milestones in music. And Bowie's probably got more than one of them. But I wanted to look something up here. So the singles were Changes and Life on Mars.
Yep.
I didn't realize Changes was a double A side. I'm just looking. Hang on. You can keep talking. There it is. I put Queen Bitch on a playlist recently because it's a great song. And I thought, I'm sure that's the album with Queen Bitch on. That's my favourite David Bowie song, probably.
There's a lot. I quite like Cooks, which he wrote for his son. I quite like Oh You Pretty Things.
Yeah.
Changes, obviously. Life on Mars, brilliant. There's a lot on there.
Yeah, it's not a bad record, is it?
No.
It's funny, when you look at an album like that now, you look at that track listing, for another artist, that could be a best of.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
My favourite example of that. Do you know the Otis Redding album, Otis Blue?
I don't know that particular album, no.
Have a look at the track listing on that album and you'll think it's the best of Otis Redding. It's absolutely unreal record. I mean, it's a phenomenal record, but just that collection of songs, just like, fuck. Who else could have done that? Okay, well, I thought you might have a bit of Bowie. It's fair enough. Like I say, he's a disruptor. Was a disruptor. And by all accounts, a very nice man. Mostly.
Mostly. Unless you were pestering him and he wanted to be left alone. That must be the thing with, like, these celebs.
Well, interestingly, so I was talking to a journalist that I commissioned a few times. And he's a really lovely writer. Well, the one day he just suddenly reveals that he was Bowie's PA for a good 10 years. And this it came about because I was trying to find out if I knew anybody that knew Peter Gabriel, because I had this crazy fucking idea. Anyway, turns out I did know somebody that knew Peter Gabriel. But what Jonathan told me, this guy called Jonathan Wingate, he said, the bigger the star, the fewer people there are between you and them. It's only when people are up and coming or whatever, and they're a bit insecure and they've got a big entourage and all of that nonsense. So, but the big ones, the established ones, there's at most one or two people between you and them.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting, but he was absolutely correct. There are. And he was that person for Bowie for many years. And he never said a bad word about Bowie. So I think that's a fairly good sign. I like Jonathan, so it's good enough for me. Bowie gets in,
cool.
So come on, what's number three?
Well, I pay for Spotify. And all the time, well, once a year, Spotify sends you a playlist of what you've played and things you might like. Until I shared my account with who was then 18-year-old son, who got into grime and obviously listened to music much more than I did and completely destroyed my You Might Also Like This.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to buy a family account and make him take all his bloody playlists with him to claim back. But not that I'm into grime music, I just think it's a bit noisy, to be fair. It did refresh my look at modern music, I guess. And I So my third choice, although it's only just out, but I did find it on Spotify, is Miles Smith. And his biggest hit that you might have heard of is Stargazing. But there are two songs I've got on my personal playlist. It's the playlist that I put on if I just want music. Stargazing and Nice to Meet You. You have to look it up.
Yeah, I've never heard of this dude. So what's the album?
The album is Talking Point. No, My Mess, My Heart, My Life, I think. It's out this week, I think.
Oh. But you've already heard it. Well, you've heard some.
Well, because it's on Spotify.
Yeah.
These songs, individual songs are.
Wow. Well, that is bang up to date.
But I think... if you love music, I took my dad to this Gladstonebury festival, and he kept saying to me, "Oh God, it's just why don't they all just shut up? Why can't they play jazz?" And I said, "Well, that's because you like jazz," and he said, "I know, but jazz is great, isn't it? No one listens to jazz anymore." And I said, "Well, people do listen to jazz because actually there is a jazz club in Twickenham, which I've offered to take you to, and you've said, 'Oh, I don't like that type of jazz.'" So I said, "Not only do you only like jazz, you only like one type of jazz, which is traditional jazz, not modern jazz, traditional jazz." And I said, "Actually, when you were growing up and dating my mum and when you first got married, that was the heyday of the Beatles, the Stones, and everything else was around at that time in the early 60s, I guess. So why do you not like?" And I said, "I remember you having Santana records and Beatles records and Rolling Stone records in your record collection. Why is it now that you will only listen to jazz and are very dismissive over everything?" But he is nearly 90. And I just thought at that time that maybe I shouldn't be so dismissive of him or jazz. But I think if you love music, you should have a listen to sort of everything. I've had to listen to grime. Maybe I just haven't come across an artist I particularly like that's in that genre. But
isn't Stormzy grime?
Yeah.
I mean, he's one of those people, he just totally transcends his genre. I'll watch that guy do anything.
Or is it, I totally agree, and I saw didn't he join Ed Sheeran on stage?
I have no idea, because I won't watch that guy do anything.
Well, Eminem was on stage with Ed Sheeran. Look, Ed Sheeran's quite commercial, but in a way, it's a bit like artists, isn't it? My nephew's an artist, went to Camberwell School of Art. You know, only wants to paint what he wants to paint. At some point, if he wants to paint, he's got to get a job painting. Because how else do these people earn money? So in a way, sometimes Bowie had to do it. Let's Dance is a commercial album. He didn't really like it at the time, but he needed to earn some money. So every now and again, these artists need to do something that's quite commercial that actually sells and makes money. So
or gets them out of their contract.
Or gets them out of their contract.
No, it's fair. It's yeah, sadly you gotta make money.
A bit like you and me as well. Love doing one thing, but actually doesn't earn us any money. So again, every now and again we have to go and do something that's a bit more commercial.
Which reminds me, sponsorships are available for Desert Island Discs.
Was that okay as the intro to that?
Not bad, Kate. Not bad. I'll edit this part.
Always thinking about you, John.
Kate, what's your one song that is not on the albums that you're going to take with you to your tropical island?
This was worse. But, you know, I was thinking if I'm stuck on my own on a tropical island, I need something that will make me smile and dance. So I love Motown too. So I chose Diana Ross, I'm Coming Out, but it was really, really hard. It could have been anything
fucking
from
great song.
Franklin, Marvin Gaye, Smokey Robinson, Otis Redding. I know we talked about him.
Midnight Train to Georgia. Coming Out is an absolute belter of a song.
Well, Midnight Train to Georgia is amazing. What's going on? Respect.
Is that
Sitting on the Dock of the Bay? I mean, they're all great, aren't they?
Yeah. You've just named some
Jackson.
Of my favourite songs. Interestingly, you mentioned Motown, and obviously Stax needs to be in any conversation as well, because I loved Isaac Hayes. But do you know who the biggest selling Motown artist ever was?
No.
Now, I think in this country it comes as a surprise, but if you're American, it probably wouldn't be a surprise. It was James Brown.
Yeah, I could probably see that.
By quite a long way, though.
Yeah.
It was pretty phenomenal. Do you know the biggest selling duo ever on Motown?
No.
Hall and Oates.
Oh, blimey.
I know. It just feels wrong, doesn't it?
It does feel wrong.
Now, I was watching the Netflix documentary about the making of the song We Are the World, which I really enjoyed. Really, really enjoyed it. And I've mentioned it on this podcast before, actually. And I loved it because it's mostly Quincy Jones talking about what happened and wrangling all of those egos, because they recorded the whole thing in one night in one studio. And it's really fascinating because they did it just after the Grammys. So the Grammys kicks out, they get all these stars in the studio. And he talks about Michael Jackson's songwriting method, which made me appreciate Michael Jackson, which I'd never done before. Stuff, just these little insights that only somebody like Quincy Jones could bring. But the part that blew my mind, and I can't remember for the life of me who said this, it might have been Huey Lewis, actually. But all the stars had been really nonchalant about being there, and nobody asked anybody else for any autographs or to sign anything until somebody opened the floodgate. And this story blew my brain in the worst way. Diana Ross started it. She walks over to Daryl Hall and says, I'm a huge fan. Would you sign this for me? Now, if I'm Daryl Hall in that situation, I'm going to say, do you not know that you're Diana Ross?
Yeah, exactly.
And like, I'm not worthy of sticking dead matches in the shadow of your shit, to put it bluntly. It's like, you're Diana Ross, dude. But then apparently everybody asked everybody to sign things.
Good.
And even Dylan was signing.
There you go.
That's a great song, though. That's a really, really, that's a really terrific song. I've got a bit of Diana Ross on a playlist, but it's the one that keeps coming up is It's My House. Mm. It's a fabulous song. Pet, Kate. You got a pet any time in your life?
Yeah, I've got a dog we had when I was growing up called Sophie. She was a grey and white collie. The runt of the litter.
Yeah.
And she was sort of left till the last. It was a local farmer. Had a dog who had a litter of puppies, and she was left. And my mum and dad went and said, okay, well, took up me and my sister. We didn't commit that one. So run to the litter. She was great. My parents lived and worked abroad for 5 years, just after I moved to London. And I had her for a couple of years. My sister had her for a couple of years until my parents got back, and then they took her back with them. Yeah, she was great. But I have a soft spot for challenging people, challenging pets.
Is that why you're here today, Kate?
Yeah. I always think holding people back is much easier than kicking people up the arse to get them to do something. Same with pets, maybe. Quite like challenges. Taking the run to the litter is always a challenge.
Okay, well, Sophie the dog.
Yeah. Well, we've got a pet now, Trevor the tortoise.
Tortoises make great pets. Not least because they live so long.
Well, they live quite long, but they don't do much.
Tortoises. They're mostly just doing tortoisey things, aren't they?
They sleep a lot.
Yeah. I would if I could get away with it.
Their diet's not that exciting either.
No, it's mine.
I was going to the salad drawer in the fridge and going, where's all the bloody salad gone? Oh, Trevor.
Do you not just do the old soaked dandelions?
No, we do that as well, because just feeding them out the salad drawer is not particularly a good thing, and they shouldn't have too much sugar because they can't digest it. But so weeds. I've had to grow weeds in the garden.
Yeah, I've been doing that.
Hibiscus flowers they love.
I haven't even got a tortoise.
Yeah, they're quite good pets because they don't run too fast, so small kids quite like them.
Plus, they're very difficult to break.
It's hard to break a tortoise.
It really is, luckily. Should have got some for my kids when they were younger, damn it. Here you go, kids. This is going to be your companion for life, and it may even outlive you.
But I think you have to give it a typical tortoise name.
Yours is Trevor.
Trevor. Trev the Rev, yeah.
And that's a typical tortoise name, is it?
Well, I think quite an old-fashioned name. Barry, Eric.
I think if I had one, I'd call it Clement.
Yeah, you see? Nice.
It's a solid name. You can trust a tortoise named Clement.
Yeah, or Trevor.
I'm not sure what you'd trust a tortoise with.
Practically anything, really.
But you could trust Clement, for sure. Okay, so it was very nice to meet Sophie the dog. Little puppy.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to move on to one object, Kate. Now this can be a luxury item. It can be something really pedestrian. It could be whatever you want. It doesn't have to be practical. It can be any old shit.
Well, I probably struggled more with this than some of the other questions. And there were two things that I thought about. One was a telescope. And one was a guitar. And actually, I chose the guitar.
Okay.
And learn how to play guitar book.
Yeah, you should have had that in your three books.
So, because actually, I'm not very good at just sitting doing nothing. So I have to be doing something. So I thought, I've always wanted to be able to play a musical instrument. And I've been too busy or too, I don't know. I was never forced to do it as a child, which I wish I had been.
Yeah, God, I bet.
Learn the piano or play the guitar. So I think I'd take a guitar and learn to play the guitar.
Okay. Fair enough.
I mean, a machete is the other thing that I could have taken, obviously. To build myself a camp or, you know.
All that shit's taken care of.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't need to worry about that. Take your guitar.
Yeah. Much better.
Yeah. Totally. You get to choose a dessert. Now, that can either be a dessert type or a specific dessert from a specific place.
Oh, this was easy. A limoncello panettone.
Okay, is that from a specific place or
no,
just a thing?
One I make regularly myself.
You make it?
I make it.
Whoa.
It's delicious.
but you make it and you love it. Now that's by itself, that's a little bit unusual.
Is it?
Because I think usually if people make things, they're like, yeah, I don't ever want to see another one of those again.
No, well, I don't make it like all the time. It's normally people at Christmas and high days, holidays. I'm not pretending I make my own pastry. Why would you make your own pastry when actually shop-bought pastry is just as good these days? So I could make panettone, because I do have a bread maker, and you can make panettone in a bread maker. But actually, I choose to buy a panettone. Do you want me to describe it?
Go for it. It's your time.
What I normally do is I normally buy a panettone, you know. You can buy them from Marks and Spencer's in Christmas tree shaped at Christmas, or you buy one from Carluccio's, which is really good. Cut it, slice it, put whipped cream in between the slices, and then soak the whole lot in limoncello. Dust it with icing sugar, and serve. I mean, you don't pour a bottle of limoncello over it. You have to be somewhat sensible.
Where's the fun in that?
You can have limoncello on the side in a glass as well. But
hang on, though. If you put your panettone and it's cut up and you got your cream layered through it, and you pour your limoncello over the top.
Yeah, well,
and then you can like collect it at the bottom, and you dust it with your icing sugar, and then you got icing sugar limoncello in the bottom.
John, it's delicious.
It does sound okay.
It is utterly delicious.
Not for my zero carb lifestyle.
No.
Yes, it does sound good.
But it's so easy to make too. It doesn't. It doesn't require a five-star chef to make
that. That is my kind of recipe.
Five-star chef.
I've just noticed that Rick Wakeman played the piano on Hunky Dory.
Did he?
He did, yeah.
Rick Wakeman is a dark horse. He's done a lot of things that, you know.
Yeah. My band played at Oakengates Town Hall in Telford once, and Rick Wakeman was playing the next night.
Mm.
He didn't come and see us. We didn't go and see him. Screw you, Wakeman.
Screw you.
Douchebag. Yeah. I was a bit disappointed that he didn't turn up. Okay, we're on to the two pieces of advice. This is one of the more difficult parts.
Yeah.
So shall we go older to younger first? Because that's the easy one, really.
Yeah, I had to write this down. I guess looking back, I would say to my younger self, stop pretending, or you don't have to pretend that you know everything. It's about stop projecting certainty that actually you don't feel. It's okay to look uncertain. It's okay to say you don't know the answer. But because the acknowledgement of that actually comes from experience and confidence and all those other things. But I do think that when we're younger, we keep all the messy bits around us to ourselves. Mm. And actually, particularly these days, it's quite good to show people the messy bits. Shows you're human. I mean, depending on how messy it is. But actually, it was the moment, and one of the things which I've always tried to be is a bit real, and I always say, I'm just me. What you see actually is who I am. I'm not hiding anything. It's just me. And that's what's helped me. Helped me deliver ice, helped me build a career, helped me build a reputation, helped me build, you know, the gaming boardroom maybe. Help me know you, John.
Every day is a bonus for you. No, but there's a, yeah, that, I think that's all very fair. I would, like, my kids always ask me, like, they'll ask me the most bizarre questions because they're kids. My youngest asked me a beauty on Sunday. He said he was looking really intently out the van window. And he just said, do shadows fall on glass or through glass? Ooh. And I'm like, God, I love your brain. Because I think fundamentally what he's asking there, are we seeing a shadow of a shadow when we see the shadow of that that's on the surface below the glass? And I just love that. I friggin' love that. But I always say to them, if I don't know something, I always say, honestly, I don't know. And I either point them to somebody that will know, or I say, but I know how to find it out. Mm. So I'll go find out and I'll come back to you. Because, you know, like you say, that not knowing everything, it's not a weakness. It's where everybody is. And, you know, it's neither a bad thing nor a good thing. It's just a thing. It's just being alive. So what about the reverse fixture? What would your younger self impart to your older self that might be of value?
I think, or I hope she would say to me, don't forget the reason why you're in the room in terms of taking risks. So don't be so good at what you're doing that you forget that actually one of the reasons why you're good at it is that you took all those risks back in the beginning, that you took a risk with a job choice, that you took a risk by choosing a mentor that was right for you at that time, that you tried something that didn't work. So don't forget the journey that got you to where you are and discount it. Keep going back to that risk-taking bit, I guess, because the only reason you are where you are is because of all those risks you took. So continue taking them.
That's not a bad bit of advice, that.
Well, I think we become very consumed with brand and reputation and trying to protect ourselves from external criticism that we end up playing a safe game. And if we're all playing a safe game, fuck, that's boring. And we all become similar. So actually, there's nothing wrong with taking a risk. Have humanity when you take the risk. Be mindful when you take the risk. But actually, continue taking the risks and pushing the boundaries. And don't say, why should I do that? Well, why shouldn't I do that? What could possibly go wrong if I did this? Okay, well, no one's going to die. So, yeah, let's take a punt on it.
Did I ever tell you what my best mate said to me?
No.
Well, we're having a conversation.
I
have said a lot of things to you, Kate. We're having a conversation, and I said to her, I don't know if I've ever told you this, Beck, but when I'm thinking about doing something really fucking stupid, it's your actual voice that I hear in my head saying, are you sure about this? And she said, it's really odd that you should say that. Because when I'm thinking about making the safe choice, your voice is in my head saying, what's the worst that can happen? So she's getting more adventurous with age and I'm getting more risk averse. We're just validating each other's choices there. In absentia, validating. So, yeah, good times. Kate Chambers, you mentioned the Gaming Boardroom there. Where can people find that?
At, funnily enough, thegamingboardroom.com.
Okay. And what can they find there, Kate?
Well, we're actually a couple of weeks away from relaunch.
Oh.
So at the moment, it's how it's been for a while since we launched. It's going to have a bit of a refresh. So we're sort of aiming for the end of July, which gives us another 6 weeks to sort our lives out and do something slightly more interesting.
Disruptive, Kate.
Disruptive. It needs a refresh. Everything needs refreshing every now and again. It's our turn. Hopefully, so I would say definitely come back towards the end of July and have a look.
Okay. Kate Chambers. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I know it's been on the cards for a while and I've resisted. But I don't know why I resisted. It's been great fun.
Me neither.